cases, 95-730, City of Seven Hills, Ohio versus Area Nations et al. Mr. Viscardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May I at this time reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal?
Watch your time.
May it please the court, my name is Raymond Viscardi, and together with Kevin Francis O'Neill in cooperation with the American Civil Liberties Union, I represent the appellant, Rabbi Abraham Weiss.
Let me ask a threshold question. Is this case moot?
No, it is not, Your Honor.
Is there still reason for this ordinance and still activity occurring?
The injunction, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes, as a matter of fact, Rabbi Weiss will be in Cleveland tomorrow to lead a group of Holocaust survivors in a small protest outside Mr. Demyanov's home. We don't believe that the case is moved. What we do believe is that the City of Seven Hills comes before the court today, albeit as appellee, and asks this court to depart from 50 years of settled First Amendment precedent and to validate a restriction on counter-demonstration, which effectively creates a First Amendment bubble in which the right to speak is not completely eviscerated, but in which the right to speak to those who might disagree with what you have to say is completely taken away. And we believe that our First Amendment jurisprudence...
Is it really taken away, counsel, or is it just it's not going to occur on the residential street in front of this hall? Is the right taken away, or is it just limited in this one locale?
Well, Your Honor, the right to confront those with opposing viewpoints in this locale is what is expressly taken away by the injunction. But as we've noted in our brief, and as was the case in the Second Circuit case of Olivieri against Ward, for the rabbi and his followers, confronting those with opposing viewpoints in this particular locale is of particular philosophical significance given the messages that are at stake. Those whom the rabbi wishes to confront are those who would use Mr. Demyanov's presence in Seven Hills as ammunition for their argument that the Holocaust never took place. There is no substitute, no better way to counter that sort of racist argument than to have 15 Dachau survivors standing with candles in silent witness of the fact that the Holocaust was very real, that it did take place, and that it happened to them. Now, confronting them separated by 2 hours or in a debate which is carried out in the newspapers lacks the immediacy and the poignancy that speaking in front of that home while the Nazis are there conveys. And that's why we believe that while it's only in this form, this particular form, that the protesters are enjoined from addressing their opponents directly, this is the form that matters. And the time that matters is when the...
Are we talking about balancing, though? We're talking about balancing the rights of the people that live on that street to be living peacefully, free from fear of any danger. Are we just balancing the rights of the people that live on the street with the rights of the other residents? We have to consider them as well.
We certainly do, Your Honor. Let me make two responses to your question. Respectfully, that balance was determined in the Court of Appeals below, and that balance was struck by the United States Supreme Court in Frisbee against Schultz. Now, in Frisbee, the United States Supreme Court considered what is the appropriate balance between the rights of residents and those who wish to picket in a residential neighborhood, and the court came to this conclusion. The only difference between a residential street and any other street, because a residential street is a quintessential public forum of the First Amendment, the only difference between a residential street and any other street for First Amendment purposes is that the protesters may not engage in the targeted picketing, that is to say, focused picketing, directly in front of and solely directed at a single residence. So that balance has already been struck by the United States Supreme Court and was resolved in accordance with Frisbee and Schultz in overturning the ordinance, the anti-picketing ordinance.
I'm talking more about the balance of the danger than a face-to-face confrontation. I'm talking about hybrid issues. The lower court made a finding that there was an issue of substantial danger. We cannot substitute, unless there's a total abuse of discretion, we are not a prior fact. And that's the judgment that the lower court made. And that's the balance that I consider that you don't seem to be addressing.
Your Honor, your question is very important, and because of that, I would like to make three distinct responses to it. First, with respect to this court's ability to review the judgment of the trial court and the Court of Appeals, this court reserved for itself in Urbana ex rel Newlin v. Dowlin the right to review the findings of fact in First Amendment cases de novo, relying on the United States Supreme Court's decision in Bose Corporation. And this court stated in 1989 that it's important to do so because it is important to come to an independent conclusion that the speech in question falls either inside or outside the protection of the First Amendment. It's also clear from the substantial telling of fact in the Court of Appeals opinion, which is far more substantial than that in the trial court's opinion, that the Court of Appeals did in fact review the record de novo, and that in reviewing the Court of Appeals decision, there's some obligation or some desirability in seeing if they made the right call. That's the first response. The second response with respect to violence, Your Honor, is that for 56 years, the United States Supreme Court has made clear that only in cases of a clear and present danger of imminent lawless conduct may speech be prohibited because it is provocative. Now, we think the record substantially establishes that the counter-demonstration in question in this case was proscribed because of risk of potential violence. In fact, on page 827 in the appendix, that is the precise language used by the Court of Appeals. The third point, even if this court were to review the lower discretion, or the lower decision for an abuse of discretion, the decision of both the trial court and the Court of Appeals would be clearly erroneous because the Court of Appeals upheld the injunction on a finding that there was the potential for lawlessness. But as we have extensively briefed, and as the United States Supreme Court has held since Terminello against Chicago, potential lawlessness is not of sufficient constitutional
moment. Let me stop you on that point. Perhaps the trial court is incorrect on that characterization of the evidence, and I want to ask you that in the brief, that you know there's reference to Rabbi Weiss's statement that should violence break out during the picketing, his group and he and his protests would not follow police orders would contribute to a possible riot. I don't know if that's accurate, and then of course the chaplain of the KKK says that you'd probably have an explosion if you put the two groups together. Is that, you're assuming that's correct characterization, and it may not be, but if it is that not, your argument has to be that's not clear and present danger. It has to be something closer to, you have to actually have the groups there, I would guess, and
yes, sure,
about ready to combat each other. Is that your argument?
Two responses with respect to that. The first is under at least one federal court decision, the Martin Luther King worshippers case from the Middle District of Tennessee, the question of whether there's a clear and present danger posed by protesting is a tactical decision that can't be made at the time a parade permit is issued, that can't be made hours or days before the event. It has to be made tactically by the police on the scene. Now, the rabbi's refusal to the police chief to disperse if attacked is precisely the same sort of refusal to disperse when confronted by onlookers and hecklers that the black civil rights marchers protesting at the South Carolina State Capitol made in Edwards against South Carolina. But the Supreme Court overturned that conviction on that refusal to disperse, saying that they themselves were peaceful, and so long as they were peaceful, they didn't have to leave based upon the unlawful activity of their opponents.
Well, I guess, again, to pick up maybe on Justice Stratton's question, a demonstration such as this on the State House grounds or in a stadium or at a state capitol seems to me to perhaps be a little different when we balance than it is in front of someone's house where if there is violence, it's not likely to be contained within the curbs of the street, I would guess. I mean, you're now in a private property, and what are the, I mean, in that situation, should there be more vigilance on the part of a court to attempt to prevent that sort of intrusion into one's private right to security and peaceful enjoyment of their property?
Certainly, Your Honor, and in response to this, I'd also like to go back to that prediction of an explosion reported by the Court of Appeals, but certainly in response to your question, there should be, but the way to do that is not to prohibit outright demonstration. Rather, consistent with the United States Supreme Court's holding in Madison, there are less obtrusive means of achieving safety.
You would not object if the court had said that there can only be two demonstrators from each side.
We would like to have more than two, and in fact, Detective Durkin...
Well, I just chose that number, but if the number was limited...
A numerical limitation, we think, would indeed be prudent, and we have no objection to it. We think that is consistent with the trial court's power. But now, a wholesale prohibition is not.
Now, the Court of Appeals held that this injunction was content neutral, and you haven't touched upon that, that it's really content based.
Yes, well, with respect to that, Your Honor, we think that under the standard for content-neutral injunctions articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court in Madison, this injunction does not pass constitutional muster, even at the lower level of analysis. But consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court's holding in Forsyth County, Georgia versus the Nationalist Movement, this injunction necessarily requires the police to inquire into what a demonstrator intends to say before he or she will be classed with a certain group of demonstrators.
But it doesn't tell the demonstrator that he or she can't say it.
No, that's true, Your Honor.
It just says you can say it during this period of time.
No, that's true.
In this location.
Now, in Forsyth County...
Is that really content? Is that content?
Yes, it is. And let me tell you why. Because in Forsyth County, the inquiry into what a demonstrator intended to say wasn't being interposed to prevent the demonstrator from speaking. It was merely being interposed to determine how much of a parade permit fee the demonstrator would have to pay. There was no sense that if you want to say, for instance, the mayor's a bad man, we won't let you speak at all. It's merely that we might charge you $450 as opposed to $275. That inquiry was held to be a content-based restriction, despite the fact that it never ended up in a prohibition.
But that seems to be an impediment, to me, a greater impediment on one's right to speak. I mean, you could put the fee so high, and obviously you could charge someone with little means a high enough fee that they couldn't speak. Here, I mean, they're allowed to speak. They'll say anything they want to on the street. Obviously not with the other groups there. That still seems to me different than the fee case.
That what's unusual about this case, Your Honor, is that they are allowed to speak, but they are not allowed to speak to whom they would like to speak. And they're not allowed to articulate a message of resistance and vigil in the face of racial extremism, which is precisely the reason that they want to speak in front of Demyanyuk's house. The difference is an all-important difference, because if they can't articulate that message, what the trial court has effectively done is create a First Amendment exclusionary zone where you can speak so long as there's no audience. You can speak so long as there's no threat that no one will disagree with you. But for 60 years, the United States Supreme Court has held that the fact that there may be disagreement in the audience, as there was in Terminallo against Chicago, or Tinker against Des Moines School District, or Gregory against Chicago, or Texas against Johnson, or Cantwell against Connecticut, the fact that someone out there may disagree, may even disagree vehemently with what you have to say, is no reason to prevent you from speaking. Now, it seems to strain credulity to say, yes, that's well and fine, but what we'll do is we'll clear the streets before provocative speakers open their mouths so that while they can speak their provocative message, there's no real reason to fear that someone might disagree.
Are you saying that there actually must be some violence at the scene before the court should step in and regulate that area?
No, sir. What there must be is the threat of imminent lawless conduct. What that means is that when it becomes clear that the demonstrators are about to violate the law, then the police have the right to arrest one or both sides to preserve public order. But as the Second Circuit noted in Woolen against Port Authority, up until that time, the obligation of the police is to protect the speakers in their right to speak.
So you're saying there has been no evidence in this case that there was violence at the scene of the picket?
That brings me back to something that the Chief Justice asked about a few minutes ago, which is that prediction from the Ku Klux Klan Grand Dragon that if protests were allowed side by side, there would be an explosion. I want to point out to the court how disingenuous that quote in the appellate court's decision is. Because if you go back to page 171 of the transcript, page 52 of the supplement, you'll see that both the beginning and the end of that sentence were omitted. And the full sentence goes something very much like this. Yes, there would, because when you protest alongside bigoted or racist people, there's bound to be an explosion, and everyone knows that Jews are prejudiced. That's the complete quote from the Grand Dragon.
But of course, we're going to see that that allegation in every one of these kinds of problems. That I recognize that prior restraint is a publication doctrine, but isn't this just simply prior restraint violation of the Constitution?
Your Honor, I see that my time is up. I have need to respond. Prior restraint applies both in parade and public demonstration cases and in publication, and comes before this or any reviewing court bearing a tremendous presumption against its validity.
And this is prior restraint against speaking.
This is prior restraint against speaking, and therefore the city comes before the court now with a tremendous burden and must show a clear present danger of imminent lawlessness in order to defend this resolution. We think the record below is far too thin to establish that, and we beg the court.
Is there any substantial authority that permits prior restraint of one's right to speak that you know of?
I think all the cases...
You can punish for the right for having improperly spoken.
Correct.
But is there any authority that you know that prohibits one from speaking or confronting?
Not in modern First Amendment jurisprudence, Your Honor, since the end of the Gitlow, Schenck, and Abrams line of cases were replaced in the late 1920s by the Dijon line of cases.
Could a city, say, adopt an ordinance that says it's a violation of city ordinance to walk into a theater and shout fire?
The old Rossoff and Justice Holmes, Your Honor, would be.
That's a prior restraint on speech. We have lots of prior restraints on speech. I would think that would be one that would pass muster, would it not?
For two reasons, it might still pass muster. That analysis was first articulated by Justice Holmes and Abrams against the United States in 1917, and Justice Holmes and Justice Brandeis later recanted the analysis that was first articulated in Abrams. Your Honor, with respect to that, that would be a prior restraint that would be a legitimate prior restraint, if at all, because there was a risk of clear and present danger of imminent lawlessness.
Yes, which is the argument, here. That's, we can, I mean, a government can restrict, can place a prior restriction on speech if the speech would create a clear and present danger.
If it creates a clear and present danger, and only if it creates a clear and present danger, then yes, because the speech might incite others to act in such a way that it is dangerous, yes. But that's not the case in this case. The record here is thoroughly devoid of any such showing. And if I may just have leave to conclude on one more note, Your Honor.
You're well into your
I see.
Before you
time.
Okay, I was.
Your argument here seems, and your brief seems to focus almost exclusively on the extent of the injunction.
Yes, sir.
Do you concede the ordinance is fully constitutional?
Your Honor, the ordinance was declared unconstitutional by the Court of Appeals, and that matter was not raised on appeal by the city. So that's not before the court today.
So that's out of here?
That's out.
We're not talking about it.
Yeah. We're here on the injunction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bisbari. Mr. Kassinger.
Thank you. Good morning, Honorable Chief Justice and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Ms. Madden, Sean Burnham, who's sitting with us. And also, in the room is Mr. Rick Pugliantello, who is the current law director of our city. At the time of this litigation in the lower courts, I was the law director for the city of Seven Hills and was asked if I would continue on with the presentation for this panel.
Since we don't have the ordinance before us, this mm-hmm. is a case that stands for the proposition that if your position would be that if the leaders of two groups say, if you let us get together and talk to each other, demonstrate to each other, we're going to have some violence, that an injunction can issue?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that that's the whole purpose of an injunction, to avoid the irreparable harm that would occur to the residents in the neighborhood, to the protesters themselves, to the news media, to the police departments that would be involved.
Is that adequately shown to the council that there's a clear and present danger of significant government interest? Is that shown?
Well, we argue that it's clearly demonstrated in the record, Your Honor. We believe that there was a clear and present danger shown that there would be imminent lawlessness, yes. We argued by, a number of things that were in the record. We argued by evidence of the police officers, some of which were trained in riot control, that indicate that the effect of spontaneous residential picketing would seriously affect the police's ability to control public order. We argue from the statement that you were...
That would be true of any protest, I guess, wouldn't it? It would be true of any protesting, any situation that involved disputing groups meeting in a public place. I suppose the police have a problem. That's why they show up on horseback and bring extra.
Well, the city of Chisholm Hills has no horseback, and we have about 22 police officers, and we can put about three on a shift per 8 hours. So I think that's another issue. That was more of the testimony here, that the city of Seven Hills is really significantly undermanned with the ability to take care of a problem of this nature.
Well, why should we consider that?
It's one of the factors that I believe would show, taken together with the statements from the KKK Grand Wizard and taken together from other other statements, that they all tend to build to show an imminent harm that will occur, a clear and present danger.
Okay, your inability to feel sufficient police protection, your inability to do that,
yes, sir,
is something to show that it's a clear and present danger of imminent harm. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that if there would be harm generated by the other statements that are in the record, that would show an additional heightened need for an injunction.
Problem. If there would be, that's what this case is all about.
Yes.
If this happens, if the two groups get together, if we don't have enough police, if we do this, if we do that, some harm may come. That's what this is all about.
Well,
nothing actually happened, did it?
No, that's right. And that's what we're trying to avoid, something actually happened.
But you have to have more proof that we have here that anything was going to happen.
I think we have sufficient proof with all respect to the Honorable Justice.
We write laws that, we interpret the law. We write opinions that affect all of the state of Ohio. And when you're raising a point that you have insufficient police, that's something that I don't think that we should take into consideration. And I think that you should address the primary issue concerning whether this injunction is restricting First Amendment rights. Is that injunction content-based, or is it content-neutral in the scrutiny? Because I think it's immaterial whether you have sufficient police in Seven Hills, because you can always take care of that problem if danger is true. So I'd like to hear you address the merits of the case.
Well, okay. We certainly believe that the injunction is content-neutral. I think the indication is that because we're classifying groups here, that invades the concept of neutrality. I think the Mattson case clearly states that the groups that the classification of groups according to viewpoints do not demonstrate a viewpoint-based purpose. To quote the court, I think that the the issue before the court is that if you start to look at groups that would be named in injunctions, then just about every injunction, if that's the criteria for being content neutral, every injunction would not be content neutral.
Well, but on that basis, Counselor, and following up on what Mr. President said, if we get right to that issue, the case, if we uphold this injunction, doesn't just affect Seven Hills. We write a broad principle that affects every injunction that could be issued in this state. Let me give you just two examples. Every now and then, once or twice a year, the Ku Klux Klan comes to Columbus and sticks out there, whatever they do over in the State House lawn. Clearly, Columbus had to spend $80,000 or $90,000 or something for extra police, put up a fence. We see a fence going up around our State House. Under that injunction, and there has been some violence in the past. Now, can the city of Columbus pass an ordinance specifically saying anytime the Ku Klux Klan comes from 8 to 12 on a particular day, everybody must stay at least one block away? That's my first one. The second one is, how do you get to the point of, if you use an injunction to prevent confrontation, then you have a strike at where you are in Lordstown, basically, up in that area. If you have a strike, Do you issue an injunction saying that the picketers cannot picket while the people who would cross the picket line are going to work to cross the picket line? Because we want to avoid confrontation, which is what this injunction says we're trying to avoid.
Okay. Well, the injunction does not avoid confrontation throughout the community at large. There can be confrontation and joint picketing right in front of the Seven Hills City Hall. It doesn't have to occur on a small side street with no sidewalks in the city of Seven Hills, which is
so
much
location
greater.
You're arguing now.
Well, that's part of it, yes.
So you'd let these two opposing groups picket at 10 o'clock in the morning against each other in front of the courthouse?
Or in front of the city hall, yes, sir. Or door to door, or by mail, or by whatever other means they have to put forth their message.
So now we're saying that we're going to issue injunctions based on geography, as opposed to, as Justice Resnick points out, content neutral, content based, or preventing the right, or preserving the right to picket and protest. Now we're saying geography is determinant of that.
I'm not so sure that it isn't an element. I think it should be considered.
Well, isn't your argument geography is that this is a private residential street in front of someone's house, and there are some other rights that people have to enjoy their private property securely and peacefully and all that, and that this, I thought that's what the trial judge was attempting to protect, that,
that's exactly
that there is a balancing here. There's free speech, yes, and so you can have your free speech, but you can't do it on a private street. Sure, take it down to City Hall where it's a public property. But this person has a right to be in their home and enjoy their home despite his terrible background. Isn't that, that's the argument, isn't it?
Well, sure.
Well, but he's not a party.
Who is not a party?
Steve. The person that,
well, I think the argument is that the city has some obligation to protect private property.
I think the city has an obligation to speak for its residents.
Isn't that what you're saying and what the Chief Justice is asking you about? Isn't that the very reason the ordinance was struck down, that it did not strictly focus on Mr. Domaniuk's home, but rather on the entire residential area, that has been found to be unconstitutional?
Yes, the original ordinance was deemed to be overbroad, and we accept that.
Yeah, because we have before us now just the injunction,
solely is the injunction.
More targeted. Let me ask you this question. What if only one of the groups, what if Rabbi Wise had said, if we're there, we have a confrontation, and the Ku Klux Klan begins to be violent, we're gonna turn the other cheek. We're going to walk down the street away, but we're not going to engage in violence. But the leader of the Ku Klux Klan said, you put us together, there's going to be violence. Is that enough to grant injunction for one party?
I believe it is enough, Your Honor.
So you have the leader of one group being able to affect the rights of the others to speak at all.
Well,
by saying, well, we're going to be violent, so don't let them speak next to us, because we're, even though the other side says, we're not going to be violent.
Does that seem right?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem right in your example, but we have one side saying there's going to be imminent violence, and they've had a history of violence, mainly the KKK with the disturbance of youth. And then you have another person saying, I'm going to hold my ground. I'm not going to leave. I'm going to disobey a police order if necessary to stand my ground, and thereby increase the presence of a potential confrontation. I think that you have a good showing.
So is the answer to my question about Columbus and the Ku Klux Klan yes? Columbus can pass that ordinance?
I have difficulty with that ordinance to that extent.
But that's what we're saying here. We can't let them confront.
Well, it's to a different extent. You're dealing with confrontation. Whenever that meeting occurs and at that location, here there is a potential for continuous and numerous meetings of picketing, which again affect the property rights and the right to domestic tranquility of the homeowners and children.
But in my example, we have past and proven violent confrontation.
Yes, sir.
In my example, we have past and proven confrontation that has resulted in violence.
Mm.
Therefore, the injunction would be okay, according to your standard. We could, Columbus could get an injunction if they passed an ordinance preventing everybody to stay a block away from the State House. We're in 10 between 8 and 12. See, that's the problem. We're on a slippery slope.
It is a difficult situation. It's a difficult balancing on a slippery slope. It's a wonderful.
Council, I
understand.
Yes, sir. Isn't the fundamental thing that the First Amendment is all about is speech that is a confrontation, that is confrontational? Is there any problem with speech that someone gives out at Walden Pond where nobody else is around to hear it? If the purpose of the First Amendment is because it contemplates rabble-rousing speech that makes others angry. And it seems to me that that's just basically fundamental to the whole purpose of the First Amendment.
You cannot say that is not part of the purpose.
It's not speech to some TV camera that comes out and gets you. We're going to be there at 10 o'clock with our signs. I mean, that's modern day dissemination of some speech.
To the point of where neither party listens to the other and tries to drown the other out and enters into nothing more than a shouting contest. I think that the speech is lost at that point. And that's the point I think we're dealing with. The courts in the Fifth Circuit Court in Kelly versus Page said the right to picket is not absolute, must not interfere with the rights of others to use the sidewalks, to deprive the public of their police protection. And that was exactly one of the issues that we raised here. Police Department of Chicago versus Mosley, the state may prohibit picketing to protect public order. Picketing does not include the right to imperil public safety or to harass others. That's the Planned Parenthood versus Jericho. There's no First Amendment right to communicate one's views to another in any way or in any place that may be desired. You have a situation where you have a Catholic audience and you don't have the right and responsibility to invade that person's home or his home setting to compel him to hear something that is an issue. And that's this balancing concept that we're dealing with.
But in this case, there's no evidence that any of that took place. There's no evidence that people testified I wasn't able to run my sidewalk. There's no one testifying I wasn't able to drive down my street. There's no evidence that people testified they weren't able to be in their homes. There's nothing. The supposition that if these two groups are let to get together, all of this might happen. Isn't that true?
Although there was direct evidence that there were 42 protesters present at the first stages from one faction.
So what? What, the sheer number? Does that mean you can't have 42 protesters?
Well, now remember, you're talking about a narrow street, and you may be familiar with the area. You're dealing with a street without sidewalks. You're dealing with limited ability to enforce the issues dealing with the preservation of peace. I don't think that we have to have a violent confrontation there to get an injunction to enjoin irreparable harm. I think that the argument that the justice raised earlier, I think, is particularly pointed. The trial court heard the facts, heard the record, saw the people testify, and saw them lean forward when they testify, or saw them use their vocal inflection. The trial court heard this matter for 3 days. The trial court made a trip to the scene and viewed the exact location. In those situations, this court has indicated, and it's somewhat axiomatic, that the court has made its posture quite clear. The issue of whether or not to grant or deny an injunction is a matter solely within the discretion of the trial court. And the reviewing court will not disturb the judgment of the trial court in absence of a clear abuse of discretion. The arguments that we hear today from opposing counsel state, and I'm going to quote, the record below is far too thin. Well, that argument is tantamount to making an argument that it is against the manifest weight of evidence. However, the important issue here is that is not the test. The test is whether or not the trial court and the Court of Appeals abused their discretion. And we've seen no showing of that. We've heard no argument to that basis.
Let me ask you, the court's order limits the number of picketers to no more than 30. Was there discussion about a lower, was the city willing to, or either side, I guess, willing to accept a lower number than that to keep down the stress on the police force and the potential for violence?
I think there was discussion with reference to numbers, yes.
I mean, if what Rabbi Weiss wants is this ability to communicate with people who need to hear his message, then it would seem to me that you pick your best debaters or best speakers and you have the debate. Maybe he wants more people to hear it, I would guess. Certainly more people to hear it.
A place where more people would hear it would be certainly appropriate. Yeah.
You've used your time.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Visvari, you've used your time, but take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, the trial court heard the evidence, the trial court visited the scene, and the trial court misapplied the law.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Assuming there was a traffic, or both groups were allowed to be there, there was a confrontation with some level of disturbance. Is the court within its power then? Is that significant? Does it then become a significant development interest?
The preservation, or the prevention of violence is, but as the Supreme Court of the United States made clear in Brady against Rockford, is when the protesters turn violent, and not before,
that they
lose their First Amendment rights. Then you can arrest them. Then you can charge them with disorderly conduct.
And join.
Yes, according to Madsen, based on the prior misconduct of the groups, you can enjoin. But Mr. Kassinger is mistaken. This isn't Madsen. In Madsen, the groups had a history of disturbance. There is no such history of disturbance here. The Court of Appeals even found that the injunction had always been respected.
How do you respond to opposing counsel's last argument that this is purely a question of abuse of discretion?
The response is twofold, Your Honor. First, actually three. First, this court has reserved to itself the right to de novo review in important First Amendment cases, and this is surely one. Secondly, the trial court did all the things that Mr. Kassinger said they did, but then they misapplied the law. They enjoined a counter-demonstration because of the potential for violence in direct derogation of the precedents of the United States Supreme Court. No trial court, whatever its discretion, has the discretion to act in derogation of the Constitution and the clear mandates of the United States Supreme Court. To the extent that the trial judge did this, he must be corrected. Thirdly and finally, upon a de novo review of this record, this court will see, as Justice Sweeney has pointed out in many of his questions, that what this case is based on is not the imminent threat of lawless conduct, but a whole series of suppositions and if. If the police aren't adequately prepared, if there are too many demonstrators, if we don't restrict the numbers, and if someone is offended, then we might have violence. That's what we're shown below. And that, under our Constitution, that timid assumption that we're coming too close to violence because people disagree, isn't a sufficient constitutional moment to permit this sort of an injunction.
Thank you, Mr. Visvari. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshall, please adjourn court.